and welcome to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of peace in our time. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by USIP's Global Campus, preparing individuals worldwide through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. And actually, this month on the Global Campus, we are offering the course Strategic Peacebuilding. And my co-host for today's podcast is the main instructor in that course, George Lopez. He's also the vice president of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding here at the United States Institute of Peace. So, George, it's good to have you on the show today.
Always good to be here, Darren. Thank you.
And our guest on today's show is Dr. Maria Steffen. She is a senior policy fellow here at the United States Institute of Peace. She is also the author, co-author of a wonderful book called Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. Fascinating, wonderful book. So we are very delighted to have you on the show with us today, Maria.
Delighted to be here, Darren. Thank you.
So this week in the course Strategic Peacebuilding, we are looking at three main themes. The first is the importance of creating linkages between insiders and outsiders in the peacebuilding processes. The second is, how do we deal with spoilers, those who have no interest in seeing a peace process succeed? And then third, this shift from a conflict resolution approach to a conflict transformation approach. And I think, Maria, having you on the show and all the work that you've done on civil resistance really places your perspectives in a valuable position as we look at all of these issues. So, George, before we kind of hand it over to Maria, were there any things you wanted to add about kind of why you see these themes being one of the seven main components of strategic peacebuilding?
Well, the first, thank you, Darren, is much of the peacebuilding enterprise automatically links insiders and outsiders, whether it's international assistance through humanitarian aid as you're recovering from war, whether it's expatriates returning home who've been away for a long while, whether it's the international peacekeeping forces that may enter. Certainly many of our own listeners and people in the course have been writing a great deal, sometimes skeptically, about peace building, about the agendas that outsiders bring. So this insider-outsider issue is a major one. Secondly, I felt very strongly that the experience of some of the more difficult peace processes and yet areas to arrive at peace are replete with the notion that long-term violence brings with it a kind of factionalization of some of the fighting forces, so that the bulk of the parties may in fact reach a strategic accord and come to a peace process, but factions within each of the fighting forces may decide, no, I'm not content with this peace, I'm going to fight on. Or there are those who are willing to give the peace process a certain amount of time, and if it's not going well, then they return to the fight. And that dilemma is an important one that bridges to certain issues that Maria is familiar with, because there may be ways in which large numbers of people can dissent from a peace process and dissent from where it's going, but adopt nonviolent methods of resistance rather than being spoilers who continue the violence. And the third area of concern is one in which I think we see these other two topics brought together in certain kinds of ways. We want to address the dynamics that link what I would call the authority figures in a peace process with the participants, with the larger processes that the international community has set for an agenda. So all of these things kind of go together in certain kinds of ways.
Great. Well, Maria, let's start with this. We have been using a couple terms here. Your book is called Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. So civil resistance, nonviolent conflict, nonviolent action, people power. Are these all the same things? And when we're talking about all of these things, what is civil resistance?
Yeah, so thanks very much, Darren. So often these terms are used interchangeably: civil resistance, nonviolent action, nonviolent struggle, nonviolent conflict, people power. You know, you can find precise definitions of each of them in the nonviolent action literature, but basically they all convey the idea of a method of struggle involving active nonviolent means and tactics ranging from protest, boycotts, to civil disobedience, non-cooperation, creation of parallel structures and institutions that basically allow ordinary people to fight for basic rights, freedoms, good governance, and challenge oppressive rule using nonviolent means. So it's a method of struggle that just employs different tactics other than violence.
So you've immersed yourself in this field. You've researched it. You've written about it. You've trained folks around the world in it. How did you find yourself getting involved in this field of civil resistance?
Yeah, I don't know that there's was that obvious moment where I decided to get deeply involved in this field, but certainly I think my upbringing in rural Vermont, which is a place that takes pride in its sort of independent-mindedness and self-organization, and sort of pick yourselves up by your bootstraps and get it done, you know, through your own action, inspired me in many ways. Just that spirit that people, ordinary people, can organize and mobilize and do great things was just part of my upbringing. I would say that watching the film while I was in graduate school, watching the film, documentary film of Force More Powerful, which some of your students may have been exposed to or seen, which documents historical nonviolent struggles around the world, from the anti-apartheid struggle to the Polish Solidarity Movement, the ouster of Pinochet in Chile, our civil rights movement here in the United States, Danish resistance to the Nazis, among others. And just seeing the footage and sort of the dynamic, vibrant nature of these people power movements got me very, very interested in pursuing this field from a more academic perspective. Because at that point, I was at the Fletcher School doing security studies, wasn't exactly sure what my area of focus was going to be, but I was very interested in this idea that people could apply force nonviolently and perhaps very effectively against even the most formidable opponents. So then it was sort of off to the races academically. And then once I started regularly meeting with activists from around the world, you know, they're mostly with the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, where from the Middle East, from Africa, from North Korea, and just, you know, imbibing their spirit of courage and defiance and the belief that they could change their situation using nonviolent means was always a source of sort of constant inspiration. And that's what sort of propelled me to keep going in this field.
Now, you said something very intentionally. One, you referred to the documentary film, A Force More Powerful, and you talked about how you began to recognize nonviolent action as a force to fight for rights and justice and freedom, etc. So we're talking about a force, we're talking about fighting. So help us out here a little bit. Where does nonviolent action or civil resistance fit within the peace-building puzzle? Mm-hmm. Does it have a place, for example, on the conflict management curve, from prevention to, is it conflict mitigation? Is it peace building? Where does civil resistance fit within the peace building field, particularly when you're talking about it as a force and as a way to fight for something?
Yeah, sure. So that's a great question. I'm not sure I necessarily buy into any sort of linear conflict curve, but I'm sure you have a lot of debate about that. But I would say that the obvious where this fits in terms of our understanding of conflict is, you know, when people can prosecute conflict, so meaning they can challenge authority, they can assert, you know, rights, freedoms, whatever, that this is, but they can do it nonviolently, this is a form of violence prevention. So I would put nonviolent conflict on the violence prevention side of the curve. I would also say that this is a way for people to transform conflicts. So on the peace building curve, so when it gets just beyond, you know, sort of basic dispute and, you know, after the negotiation, how do you transform relationships? How do you transform unjust power structures in society? This often requires power shifts. It requires putting pressure on certain structures where oppression and institutionalized racism and discrimination lie. So it's a way for people to prosecute conflict. So it's part of that side of the curve, but also transformation of conflict. So it's, I think you can have a, there's relevance and there's insertion points at various parts of the conflict curve. But George, you may have some thoughts on that.
Well, I just want to build from your really great characterization here, because we've got both the theory and praxis thus far and the good placement by Maria in the conflict cycle, but also I think then begging a number of questions. Let me begin at the start and the placement of the conflict cycle. I think one of the things that's been lacking in theory, but you address very well as what can happen in practice, is that we've tended to see conflict resolution giving way, and we even sort of advocated in the course, you can't be trapped in a conflict resolution model. You've got to have conflict transformation among parties. They've got to commit to building a new social and political relationship going forward that's no longer based on violence. We see that as something that's related to the end of the conflict cycle, when it in fact could be very, very much in a given national tinderbox key to conflict violent prevention and the real outbreak of civil war. It's also the case that on the other side, after the agreement has been signed, after sporadic violence has occurred with spoilers and various others, that a large cluster of dissenting people, now empowered, organized new ways, in part by the peace process, and having a clarity about what institutions and values they want to assert in their society, they have that people power that they didn't have under conditions of violence. And they don't want to exercise as part of a repressive system, but they want to exercise in the voice of more people power in the best representational and democratic way. I also think that one of the things this discussion, you know, brings to my sensibilities and maybe some of our listeners as well is how underapplied, maybe from those of us as peace practitioners, is the civil resistance model as part of the conflict transformation paradigm, so that you can tell parties at the table who feel like, well, we're the weaker party, we're going to get disadvantaged by this settlement, etc., that we're about to sign, so we're going to stay fighting in the field, that now part of the transformational process is you lay down the arms, but you don't at all lay down the will to protest or to form bigger collective groups to assert your rights.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the kinds of trainings that Maria and our colleagues at ICNC and here at USIP can do to assure parties in the peace process that there's still a way forward to assert rights, to resist repression and coercion, to build towards a better peace functionally on the ground. There's a whole area of nonviolent action that's yet to be explored in that area.
Yeah, and I'd like to invite our listeners online to join the conversation with their questions or their comments. If you have a question or comment, you can let our producer Vanessa know by clicking the raise hand button on your GoToWebinar control panel, letting her know that you have something to share, and we'll bring you in on the show. And I believe we have a comment from somebody online. Vanessa.
I'm going to say longtime listener David Boussard has a question for Maria. He's in the DRC, and so his question is framed in the DRC context. Does or does not the nonviolent civil resistance sector ultimately complement the use of arms before the power shift, assuming that comes?
So you often hear, especially in protracted conflicts and where there's a lot of repression and a lot of crackdowns on nonviolent protesters, that you need an armed wing or you need some type of armed resistance, you know, and that nonviolent mobilization really should just serve the armed insurgency or the armed wing. In fact, I think the opposite is true. I think actually, and this is borne out in evidence and in data that my co-author Erica Chenoweth has been collecting, that in fact, violent and nonviolent resistance go together like oil and water, meaning they don't mix very well. What happens is, you know, when you assume that armed resistance can be mixed in, or that nonviolent protest is mainly just to reinforce the armed insurgency, what the result is often greater crackdowns by regimes, more violence, less discrimination in the use of violence, which translates into more destruction, more displacement, and the like. And the problem with thinking that these two strategies can go together is that the problem with violence is that it tends to discourage participation. So if you assume that by mixing or that by encouraging people to support an armed insurgency, you'll get more power, more participation, history just doesn't bear that out. And when you add violence to the mix, you are going to decrease popular participation because the vast majority of people in any society are not going to be willing to engage in any type of violence. And, you know, the fear level increases as these tactics are mixed. So I think it's a bit of a fallacy, so a false belief that the two can coexist, that they're mutually reinforcing, because evidence exists that completely sort of disproves that notion.
Let me just jump in here with one point, because I think, you know, some people say tough cases shouldn't make the rules or support the wide array of facts. But you know, obviously, one of our toughest cases is Syria. And I welcome Maria's own analysis here, but I think a number of us felt in the peace-building community that what turned part of the Syrian conflict much, much more bloody was when there was a decision by a number of defectors from the regime in the military to come to the side of the protests and say, you can't fight this regime nonviolently. You can only fight the force with force. We're the defecting army. We can help you. We've got friends elsewhere. Let's mobilize. Let's go. You can continue to demonstrate in the streets and squares, but now we're going to be the militant wing. And that just then unleashes all the boundaries that might have existed on the Assad regime and began to escalate into what we've seen now. I don't want to be overly simplistic about it, but I think this, unless a nonviolent resistance, which is a heavy load for them, can impose a kind of discipline on defectors, that if you join the movement, you're joining, accepting the method, that then this falls very much in the realm of what Maria has so smartly stated.
Yeah, that actually, the spoilers issue is an interesting one. And my question is, how does a nonviolent movement deal with spoilers within its own movement at a micro level? So, for example, I'm thinking about, George mentioned nonviolent discipline. How does a nonviolent movement deal with members who want to participate in the struggle but are unable to maintain that nonviolent discipline? You and others, Maria, have talked about the importance of unity and planning to make a nonviolent movement successful. So you could consider those who fracture the unity that a movement is trying to create with other groups. Those who, again, are creating those fractures, they could be considered spoilers within the kind of micro level of the movement itself, or individuals who just want to jump into a campaign or an action without thinking it out and planning it and sequencing it. How are there some examples of how nonviolent movements have dealt with spoilers at that level?
So you're absolutely right to note that this is probably the most significant challenge for nonviolent movements and civil resistance. Because when you think about it, why do civil resistance movements succeed? They succeed certainly relative to armed insurgencies because they tend to attract much larger and more diverse participation. So participation is the key element. The challenge is, as you increase participation, you increase the likelihood that people will join the movement who may not take nonviolent discipline so seriously, or who may have different understandings of how nonviolent action works. And so, you know, encouraging participation while maintaining nonviolent discipline is a huge challenge. Movements adopt different sort of approaches and methods to maintaining nonviolent discipline within their movement. First and foremost, I would say movement leaders need to be able to explain why and how a nonviolent resistance campaign movement will succeed. They need to be able to come up with a convincing case for why the nonviolent discipline, why the participation, why engaging in forceful, albeit nonviolent tactics, is the way to go and will achieve victory. So that will at least begin to challenge. Some people will say we need to add violence, or, you know, we need to attract media attention or something like this.
Diversity of tactics.
Diversity of tactics, right? And this gets into the whole, you know, sabotage and do we use these tactics and the like. So being able to come up with a compelling strategic case, movement movements, from the Otpor movement in Serbia to Brazil, most recently with the anti-corruption sort of protests, come up with codes of conduct for members. So basically, to participate in any action or nonviolent tactic campaign, you have to agree to certain rules and guidelines, and you're basically signing your life away when you join the movement that you will not engage in violence. And frankly, you will be forced to leave a movement if you engage in acts of violence. And again, this is generally not done on moral or ethical grounds. Sometimes it is, but it's often reinforced on strategic grounds. Violence doesn't help our movement, and here's why it should be prohibited. So I think the codes of conduct, I think the strategic rationale, and I would also say historically it's been quite useful when former armed members or people who have taken up arms in the past can explain to people, especially in really repressive environments, why nonviolent resistance is going to be more effective and strategically advantageous. So they tend to have a lot of credibility in the streets, if you will. So that has been helpful historically for nonviolent movements. So those are just a few.
Let me add one other layer here, and that's to talk about the importance of the rule of law to peace processes. Even with stark disagreements among two or three fighting factions about who's upholding and who's not upholding the principles of the peace agreement, one of the things that each of the parties have probably agreed to as part of the peace process is that rule of law will come to replace the anarchy and the arbitrariness of the violence, and that you're going to give up the barrel of the gun for a kind of ballot box and for an attention to the building of institutions. So one of the strong arguments a resistance or a popular movement can make is that, look, we may disagree on outcomes, we may disagree on policy positions, but we can't disagree on the notion that we're all better off, even in these disagreements, to make sure that the police are an effective institution, that we don't have factional fighting that's stronger than the police and wants to subvert the law. So what you do with your spoilers is say you must come under the rule of law. If you don't want to come under the rule of law, it's not about that we disagree so much on political outcomes and where the peace ought to go. It's that we very much disagree on what a fundamental cornerstone of peace will be, whatever its flavor. And that's you must have rule of law, which calls for an end to violence.
Yeah. And I'd also say, you know, another little tip is giving people stuff to do is generally very helpful in movements, and like diversifying tactically so that they stay interested and engaged and they can use their creative rabble-rouser nature, especially young people who are more apt to be spoilers. So tactical diversification tends to be very important. I would just, one point on George's mention of the peace accords and peace agreements and negotiations. It's true that people who feel outside of a negotiating process or, you know, disadvantage can break away and engage in acts of civil resistance just to, you know, advance their interests. I would also say, though, that in many cases where you've had profound power asymmetries, you would not have a peace accord. You would not have meaningful negotiations absent civil resistance. Really, there would have been a Liberia peace accord without mass pressure by women and others putting pressure on the armed groups and the government to actually sit at the table and negotiate. Guatemala peace process, absent popular pressure. I mean, there are so many cases. So here's again, we're on the conflict curve. How you get to peace accords in many cases is a result of popular pressure and participation in civil resistance.
Now, do we think that those realities are reflected in our histories and our narratives? Now, of course, there's a great documentary film, Pray the Devil Back to Hell, that talks about the role that women played in that peace process and the nonviolent actions that they took. And there are, again, many great books and documentaries that we can turn to. But I think it's those of us who are in the peace-building field or civil resistance field that know of them and turn to them. But I'm thinking about the high school student, wherever they are around the world, learning about their country's own history. And my sense is that oftentimes the punctuation points in those histories and those narratives are violent acts of wars and battles. And this goes to this shift from a conflict resolution to conflict transformation approach. But I would actually say more broadly just this idea of transformation. We need to transform the way that we understand how social change has occurred globally in a variety of different cultures. And until this sense of who has power, how it can be developed, how it can be wielded without using violence, unless those stories are told and people are familiar with them, it's no wonder that we tend to turn to violence as a way to create some type of social change, because that's what we know. Those are the stories that we've heard. Do we agree with that?
Well, I think the narrative issue is so critically important. I think most of us in the peace-building field recognize that the narrative of war not only dominates dramatically the way we characterize the way a peace comes about, but that it also casts a long shadow even past the peace accord in a way in which pockets of resistance while the war was ongoing or cross-rival small peace was developed in certain communities before the larger peace was achieved. All of those things are stories untold. I look at the Colombia peace process right now, which is maybe on the verge of historic accord and is ratified among the FARC and the government three of the five big provisions to get to the full peace. We couldn't have possibly have done that if there weren't the number of years prior to this with communities of different factions coming together and creating zones of peace. Pockets of Colombia have been so peaceful over the last 5 or 6 years compared to times past because people changed the events on the ground. But it wasn't making highlights or headlines in the various processes, even in the country itself. Even the terrible Gaza-Israeli war of this summer still had various peace communities among Palestinians and Israelis trying to maximize the dialogue across them and trying to find a way to show that there's more that binds them together than that separates them, that there are alternatives here. And those narratives are just now starting to come to be known a bit, but also lost in a lot of the bitterness about the way that the conflict unfolded. One of the things that we want to involve peace builders in locales in is the ability to get that story out. The ability to make sure that that narrative and the success stories of when killing could have continued but didn't as a voluntary experience of people, that's what solidifies the chances for real peace.
You are listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by USIP's Global Campus, preparing individuals worldwide through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. My co-host for today's show is George Lopez. He's also the main instructor in the online course we're offering on the Global Campus called Strategic Peacebuilding. And our guest is Maria Stephan. We also want to invite our listeners online to help us guide the conversation with your questions and your comments. You can let our producer, Vanessa, know that you have a question by clicking the raise hand button. She'll start to communicate with you, and we can bring you in onto the show. Maria, any of your thoughts in terms of the narrative and the stories that individuals grow up with that influence how they pursue social change, particularly under highly authoritarian conditions where they face tremendous amounts of repression? There is that, dare I say, inclination to say we've got to, quote, fight fire with fire. And if I'm faced with horrible violence, the only way to hit back is with further violence. That's a reality out there a lot of people face. How do you respond to that that real struggle that people have, and then you come to them with, or anyone who endorses nonviolent action with, no, don't use violence. Use these nonviolent methods and tactics. What does that look like, particularly under situations where people face extreme violence?
So that's a big challenge, because the instinct when you're faced with massive violence, oppression, is to want to fight back. And, you know, it's sort of instinctual, in a sense, to want to lash back. But I guess, you know, the first point is, okay, step back, step away from the normal reaction to the fundamental question of, do you want to win? So if you want to win in your struggle, then you have to think about a strategy. And you have to think about a theory of how you're going to win. And you have to come up with the idea of, well, what type of struggle is going to allow our campaign or movement to most effectively put pressure on the opponent, to effectively win the active participation of key groups in society? What strategy is going to allow us to do that? And I think that's sort of the starting point of what you know is more likely to lead to victory. And the sense that, you know, responding with violence is often therapeutic. and we know this, like lashing back, it may feel good and the right thing to do, but therapy is not strategy. And I think that's got to be sort of the starting point of any conversation about this, is if you care about winning, really let's talk about how you get there. And then, you know, just the idea, I agree with you about the narrative and the stories. I mean, even in our country, in the United States, I mean, we grew up thinking that the struggle, the Revolutionary War against the British was all about a series of battles and you know, killing the redcoats. And we studied battle after battle after battle. Look, before the first shot was fired, the colonies had, for all intents and purposes, broken away from the British government. They had created entirely new self-government that was distinct, no taxation without representation. So the breaking off had already occurred, essentially, and so much of the sort of the social, the self-organization was happening, you know, before the sort of the armed campaigns. But how many people have studied that part of our Revolutionary War strategy as well? So anyway, so those are just a couple of thoughts.
On the argument of, are you interested in winning? And if you're interested in winning, then let's think about what strategy is going to get you there. You and your co-author Erica Chenoweth talk a little bit about that. You quantitatively sought out to show how do violent and nonviolent movements compare to one another, and what were the outcomes of that research?
Yeah, so we undertook this study with a very open mind. My co-author, Erica Chenoweth, her background is in political violence and terrorism. And frankly, she was hearing some of us who are more deeply involved in nonviolent resistance work and with activists. She heard us constantly talk about how effective it could be. And in this case, in that case, you know, it was effective. But she was incredibly skeptical, as many people are, about the effectiveness of this method of struggle, especially against the toughest opponents, the most repressive opponents. So basically, we joined forces a few years ago and decided to create a data set where we looked at 323 campaigns, violent and nonviolent, against three categories of sort of very tough opponents. So these were campaigns that challenged incumbent regimes, and these were campaigns for territorial self-determination or secession. So we wanted to address cases where normally people would think that nonviolent anything would not have a chance. And so basically we compiled a data set, the nonviolent and violent conflict outcome data set. To be classified or to be in the data set, you needed to have at least 1,000 observed participants just in these three categories of campaigns. And we found holding constant, you know, government's willingness to use violence and repression, GDP, ethnic divisions or sect divisions in a society, we found holding all of these structural variables constant, that nonviolent campaigns succeeded 53% of the time compared to 26% for armed campaigns. So nonviolent resistance was twice as effective strategically and historically as armed campaigns. And then the rest of the book, we're basically explaining why that's the case.
Fascinating. How has that book been received in those numbers? Because yes, your book has been given many awards, and you can show your methods, and those have been, again, reviewed, peer-reviewed by other scholars in the field. But when you present that idea, I sense that it's probably difficult for people to swallow and say, that just doesn't seem right. You're saying that nonviolent movements are twice as likely to succeed as violent movements. What has been the reception when you share this research to audiences around the world?
So it definitely varies. Some are, you know, more instinctually willing to accept the results because it sort of supports some of their own belief systems. Many people are very skeptical, and they'll ask about specific cases and, you know, really in divided societies, still nonviolent resistance, you know, succeeds. Still in cases where the regime used live fire against dissidents and protesters, nonviolence still succeeded. And the answer is yes. I mean, so you have to start with sort of what the data suggests, and then, you know, and then go a little bit deeper, you know, with the questioner or the skeptics about why it's the case. And again, I think if your frame, especially when engaging with the skeptics, is more on strategy, less on morality and more on strategy, you tend to have a more receptive audience. I found some of the probably the most receptive audiences are in the military. So folks from the war colleges and the military academies around the world, because they speak the language of strategy, they can understand it in certain ways. And so there hasn't been as much sort of skepticism, as much from that section. I would say people who are really deeply believing in the efficacy of revolutionary violence, who tend to be a bit on the far left of the ideological spectrum, these tend to be the greatest skeptics, and they think that our research is basically trying to undermine otherwise effective movements, that it's part of an imperialist plot. And so we've heard these type of critiques, but then you just have to go back and say, show me the data. Show me the data, and then let's have a conversation about it.
But even there, I want to, you know, having watched Maria in a number of these forums and also been part of these kinds of discussions in other venues, that people reach for the case of their choice. See, Gandhi did this against the British in India, but he didn't do it against Stalin, all right? Or, forget about small resistance in Norway and Denmark or wherever. You know, Hitler had his way. And even, it's shocking to me sometimes, a lack of recognition of the role of nonviolence in the change in apartheid in South Africa. People think that, no, it was all violent struggle. That's why Mandela and these guys were in jail, because it was all violence. And a complete lack of recognition of the role of unions, the churches, even alliances between blacks and whites in South Africa to change the system. And all of that be part of the pressure that led to change. So you know, don't confuse me with the data is always going to be an argument for some people. And those big cases that they can pull out always puts the bias in the direction of saying, no, civil resistance isn't going to work in the Middle East. And people now historically forget about the First Intifada and what happened.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear from some of our listeners in terms of your experiences learning about the history of nonviolent action in your own countries. Were you introduced to nonviolent action at an early age? And then also from listeners who have experience working in conflict-affected communities, do you feel that nonviolent action actually could play a significant and strategic role in transforming that conflict? So we'd love to bring your stories and perspectives into the show. Maria, a lot has happened over the last 10 years related to civil resistance. I mean, most recently, I think a lot of people are following the story of protesters, demonstrators for greater democracy in Hong Kong. Then, of course, there's been the Occupy movement, which is not getting as much coverage as it was, but that has been a big story in the United States. Indignados in Spain, Caravan of Solace in Mexico, the Arab Spring, of course. In the circles in which you run, whether it's at a government level, foreign policy sector, have perceptions been shifting at all given what's been happening around the globe with civil resistance? Do you feel like there's been a shift in terms of how people understand it or see its utility?
The Arab world was considered for a long time, especially in this town in Washington, to be the region of the world that would always be immune to popular pressure for lots of structural reasons, oil, bad dictatorships, and the like. And so I think there was a lot of shock when people started rising up as quickly as they did against the regimes in the Middle East. And so there tends to be always a bit of a bias in favor of sort of a structural interpretation of world events, meaning this can only happen in certain places under certain regime types with certain historical moments and the like. But so I think, you know, Arab Spring and beyond, I think there actually is just, based on my interaction with more the policy community, there's a much greater appreciation for the role of human agency in global politics writ large. So I think there's a greater sort of realization that individuals coming together collectively to exert voice and to mobilize is here to stay. There is sometimes confusion about how to deal with them, and engaging effectively with diffuse, leaderless movements is hard. It's not easy to know how to do that effectively, and given the fact that nonviolent movements succeed because they're perceived as locally rooted and legitimate and credible. So knowing how external actors should engage with these campaigns and movements is tough, but I would say that there is a much greater appreciation that sort of people power is something that is going to be staying with us for a long time.
And I think this raises a series of very important questions that our literature, maybe a bit of our practice, but our literature in the peace-building field doesn't sufficiently address. I mean, we know that in practice, we're always interested in can we stand up and build up more civil society? But the notion is of civil society in a restorative way because it's been destroyed by war, and a little less about it's important to build up civil society because that bulwark of local organization defined by locals and taking form under their own terms is not only critical to the success of the insider-outsider linkage, but it's also likely to be a bulwark against a peace accord leading to repression or moving in the direction of favoritism for only one faction to benefit from the peace. The stronger the civil society fabric, the more institutions that rise up out of local civil society creates the strength of resisting improper change or disadvantaged change or illegal change. And I think that that dynamic is critical. I mean, certainly part of what unfolded in Egypt and the resistance that came out when the military overthrew the duly elected government was people now protesting the notion, not so much everyone because they were in support of Morsi and support of a particular political view of Islam, as much as, wait a minute, the rule of law created by civil society led to an election, and now the duly elected government is overthrown, regardless of its competencies, regardless of some of its biases. You have to understand you can't have one without the other. You can't have the rule of law without strong civil society. You can't have rule of law violated without civil society now taking action in the streets.
And you look at one classic case of where rule of law and civil resistance are coming together. You mentioned Hong Kong. So what are the student union members and Occupy Central and all the other protesters in Hong Kong, what are they fighting about? What are they on the streets about? They're essentially out on the streets to defend the basic law, which calls for universal suffrage, which is being violated by Beijing. So in a sense, their resistance is very much about upholding a rule of law. But, you know, according to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, to which Hong Kong is a signatory, and to the basic law, which calls for, you know, universal suffrage, meaning everybody can elect their chief executive, which was prohibited by a recent promulgation from Beijing.
So I want to take us back to the insider-outsider link theme that's been going on in the course this week. And George, you noted in some of your lectures that during cooperation between insiders and outsiders, that outsiders must recognize the tension that they're going to face when they try and introduce new themes, methods, patterns of inclusion, methods of struggle into local practices that have been culturally or socially or politically exclusionary. So in a best case scenario, outsiders are able to build trust and explain the value of new ideas to those insiders who are deeply skeptical, as Maria, you talked about earlier. In a more problematic case, the relationship can smack of paternalism. For example, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, where an internationally appointed high representative has the power to force laws onto locals or override regulations or procedures that locals have implemented, but that are deemed in the violation of the 95 Dayton Agreement. So Bosnia may not be the best case to hold up as an example of successful peace building, but I know you have a lot of experience with this, George. So what are some of the examples or cases of best practices between insiders and outsiders where new ideas and practices were introduced, and although there may have been some opposition and pushback, they were eventually embraced? And I think we can talk about this largely in peace building, but also civil resistance. Are there examples where someone introduced the idea of let's struggle nonviolently, and there was some initial pushback, but eventually there was an embrace of that method?
Yeah, I think it's very important to see that the insider-outsider linkage takes a real developmental and changing pattern over time. I think the characterization of concern about being paternalistic or impositional about a set of values from outside to in occurs at different phases of the process, and maybe it's often good news when you can get to that point that insider organization, growth of their civil society, a willingness to take control of their own future conflict transformation pushes back against the outsiders. But what we often see there is that pushback sometimes is one of local norms versus international norms. So one might say any given population has the right to resist a particular form of economic organization and a blueprint for a constitution brought on it by an outside force. So let's say Sunni Iraqis in 2002, 2003, watching all the political positions in the reorganized government go to Shias, had a right to resist in certain ways against the U.S. force. And unfortunately, that situation was force against force in a military form. But they were closed out of a peace dialogue and peace process, and as locals weren't listened to about their rights and their need to be part of a community that was emerging in a new government, a new way. And here we are 12 years later, back fighting about the same kind of issues. On the other hand, you have a process in the Philippines where United Nations agencies, international religious actors, to a certain extent the United States government and others, interacted with Filipinos and those in the zones in Mindanao, particularly Islamic actors, local actors with certain ethnicities different from Manila, and claims about even resource use, all these different dynamics operating. And the more that international agencies played a role in dialogue between the government and those locals, they were able to be able to raise questions about, just because a group is pursuing a set of values based in their religion doesn't make them religious extremists. Just because a group is trying to assert control over a long populated area by their people and the resources in it doesn't mean that they're trying to opt for total independence or are Marxist. Just because a group is found a different way of talking about the organization of themselves and others in a more federalist system and you want a big central government doesn't mean that they're revolutionaries. And I think there are times where outsiders can bring more conciliatory, opening up approaches. On the other hand, then you go to an Afghanistan where the outsiders, the West, particularly the multilateral coalition, not just the U.S., of Westerners, is seen as imposing gender opportunities and roles that many, not all, but many in the local culture are unwilling to accept because they have more strict concerns based in religion about the place of women in the society. There will always be a universalist versus local tension about certain norms, laws, and the like. As long as that struggle continues nonviolently, that's a struggle that's part of the conflict transformation enterprise. But it's also the case that in those situations where it's been a success, it's very much a long dialogue, it's very much trial and error, it's a little bit give on each side. I think, again, the Colombia peace process over the last 3 years really exemplifies this as well. You have accords now between local areas and the federal government, which you would not have had 5 years ago, because of listening more to the insiders and what they mean by reparations, what they mean by the right to return home, what they mean by more accountability of those who perpetrated the violence, and how the government now, in the security of being in a strong position, is willing to listen to those in new ways.
Yeah, I mean, Maria, you've made the case in your articles and in your books that nonviolent action is a method of struggle that does rely primarily and most importantly on local indigenous skills and knowledge, and that outsiders intervening may actually be counterproductive and actually harm the movement at times. So given that, what role can outsiders or third-party actors play to support nonviolent civic mobilization?
Yes. So, I mean, I've never heard of a case where an outsider has come in with the brilliant idea of nonviolent resistance and convinced the local population that they would succeed. So this is generally not how it happens. Generally, in any society, you know, there are nonviolent activists and there's some aspect of mobilization. But the useful, and you're right, that some types of external intervention can backfire. So if done incorrectly, improperly, it can delegitimize a movement that otherwise is perceived as being homegrown and representative. So I think when we think about external support, there are two main categories of external support that can be helpful. And the first is, you know, which type of governmental and non-governmental support can help create an enabling environment for nonviolent activism to take root and sustain itself. So at least helping to shape the environment through relationships with government. governments, with militaries, with foreign aid, to leverage foreign aid. So these are certain tools in that category. And then how can external aid provide catalytic support to activists and movements? So whether that takes the form of small grants that are used by local actors to buy t-shirts and whistles and spray paint and things like this, so very specific forms of small monetary aid, or the sharing of lessons learned and materials about previous and other historical nonviolent movements. So the whole just sharing of information and, you know, materials, films, training guides that ultimately the local activists have to adapt to their own circumstances and take these kind of lessons. So I think helping create the space and providing timely support, historically, when that support is done multilaterally, as opposed to just one government providing support to a movement, it tends to be more helpful, and it can help the local movement sort of deflect the criticism that, you know, they're puppets of a particular government or a foreign agent. But we also have to be realistic in the sense that repressive governments, authoritarian governments, will always, I always insist that domestic opposition is either foreign-backed, or they are illegitimate, or they are terrorists. I can't think of a case where a government has not said that that is the case. And so, as external actors, of course, you have to be smart. You have to listen to what the activists say they need. But also, external actors should not shy away and just adhere to the rules that are being sort of set out by these type of regimes, because that's not supportive of human rights at all. So I think, you know, starting with the perspective of listening to the activists to say what they need, and small money tends to be more useful in many cases, small targeted money, but the sharing of information and knowledge, know-how, skills, training, and how to think strategically about struggles without giving specific tactical or strategic advice, allowing peers and activists from previous struggles to meet and engage with activists who are involved in current struggles, these are the types of external support that in a nonviolent resistance context seem to be helpful.
And the historical, both contemporary and long-term validation of what Maria said is so important. I mean, in the American South itself, as Martin Luther King's organized movement of protest and nonviolent resistance took hold, the first thing you heard from the city or the state elders in southern states or cities was that, well, these are outside protesters. You know, and King himself, in the classic letter from the Birmingham jail, addresses the first charge from his fellow clerics: you've come here to foment dissent. And his response is, we came to Birmingham because there was injustice in Birmingham. Assad, as the success of the movements grow after Friday prayers, says these are outside agitators. And then weaves a, you know, an incredible narrative that not only are the outside agitators sparking the nonviolence, but they're sparking then the violence as his own defectors leave, and ultimately carries that narrative, you know, pretty far. Mr. Putin, right now, suggesting that it's totally local what's going on in the violent resistance in eastern Ukraine to the establishment of a functioning state as a result of the nonviolent demonstration, and claiming that the nonviolent demonstrations that overthrew the Ukrainian president have nothing to do with corruption, or that they're totally steeped in outside Western influence. So this theme of influence, local versus global, and this is carries us over the course of 50, 60 years.
Well, George, you mentioned Dr. King's letter from a Birmingham jail, and that's also where the famous quote is, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." And so, Maria, I want to kind of take that sentiment and connect it to something you said earlier about, you know, I know of no case where an outsider has come in and said, use nonviolent struggle because it will succeed. Yet even earlier in our conversation, you talked a little bit about that message needs to get out, that it is a better way. If you want to win, that's a method of struggle that should be used. So tell us a little bit about, one, what's your vision for how to spread the idea that nonviolent action is, one, a force that you can use to fight strategically and successfully against even the most extreme violent opponents, and what role do outsiders play in spreading that message?
Right. So that's a great point. Maybe I was not clear earlier, Darren. So I would just say, put yourself in the shoes of an activist in a really repressive environment where you've been beaten up, you've seen family members killed, whatever. Would you want to listen to a white person coming in from a developed Western country preaching nonviolent resistance? Would that be convincing for you? Probably not. But yet there are a lot of people in society who have read, who can read the materials, who have seen films, you know, who can internalize the lessons learned, but without an outsider coming in and being the preacher. So I guess that's, I just sort of step back from that, that it has to be the message and the education process to really take root has to be local and indigenous. But of course, there, as George said, there's a role for international solidarity. I mean, historically, from the anti-apartheid struggle to the East Timorese independence movement, I mean, external actors and international solidarity movements have been very important in terms of providing moral support, providing material support, putting pressure on governments who were supporting unsavory regimes that were suppressing and using force against nonviolent protesters. So there's definitely a huge role for international solidarity. My only point would be that this sort of knowledge and know-how just has to be disseminated and really inculcated by the local actors themselves.
And the age of the internet and the flow of information, yeah, in a sense, lessens the focus on outsiders have provided this, and more a sense of discovery from a world of ideas, unbounded by place and time, by locals themselves. Right. And so, you know, accurately or not accurately, you heard in U.S. circles, by gosh, isn't that interesting? Tahrir Square or wherever is playing it out just like Gene Sharp said. And it wasn't that the shadow of Gene Sharp necessarily came to these people and outside advisors, much as people discover good ideas as they need them.
So to close us out, Maria, what is the one biggest challenge you see in civil resistance becoming a more accepted and understood method of struggle? And what do you see as the biggest obstacle for the spread of civil resistance as a method of struggle? An easy, you know, concluding question for you there.
No, that's good. So, I mean, I think the biggest challenge is just the frustration, especially in cases where there's been sort of people power uprisings. And I think about the Arab Spring, for example, now, and just sort of the protest fatigue that's set in different places, the Middle East and beyond, and just the belief that, you know, really, can we bring about change? And, you know, we thought we brought about systemic change, but then we're sort of back with a really hard system and a corrupt system. So just sort of maintaining the sense and sort of convincing people that, yes, I mean, democratic development, peace building is not a linear process. There are setbacks along the way, but at the end of the day, just the process of engaging in nonviolent mobilization tends to be to reinforce social norms and behaviors that are good for the society. So I think just, you know, sort of keeping up morale and the believability that this strategy can work, addressing sort of the protest fatigue, and frankly, helping people and communities go from protests to sort of the politics, and sort of really supporting that critical inflection point between mass movements and what we all know is needed for democratic consolidation and sort of sustained peace in societies.
Let me jump on that for the last few seconds that we have. I take away from this hour together that we in the peace building field need to link more of the things we do to the potential for nonviolent struggle on all sides. For example, I mean, if you're trying to establish rule of law in a society which hasn't had it, one of the things we want to do is just policing, fair policing, community policing, policing based more on dialogue and accord with people in the society rather than the brute use of force. Well, that it demands certain kinds of training and discipline. Nonviolent policing, let's say. At the same time, you want citizens to be able to protect their rights when policing or security services or others overstep their bounds in a repressive way. But you want that protest not to be violent riots to escalate the violence. You want it to be more disciplined. We may, in the peacekeeping and peacebuilding community, need to think more creatively about the application across all of civil society in these kinds of approaches, because it gives a window that conflict and disagreement can still thrive, but it no longer has to be based out of the violence that has been the past of the 20 or 30 years. You can assert your rights, protect your identities, etc. You can protect rule of law and property, but all without resort to violence.
Thank you to both of you. You've been listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast that brings together scholars, practitioners, and activists to discuss and debate the important work of peace in our time. I've been your host, Darren Cambridge. Our co-host has been George Lopez, and our guest has been Maria Stephan. Thanks to both of you for joining us on the show today.
Thanks, Darren.
Thank you.
The Peace Frequency is brought to you by USIP's Global Campus, preparing individuals worldwide through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. Our executive producer is Peter Weinberger. Our producers are Vanessa Francis, Emily Mella, and Leah Cullins. Our sound engineers are Dominic Curley and Blake Mobley, and our graphic designer is Manuel Leon. Thanks for joining us, and we look forward to hearing you next week.